Good evening, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of The Bog Live here every single Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern on DLive.tv/Dave Martell. Tonight we have a really awesome guest, but before we get started, I want to give a shout-out to our buddy, the Iron Age Jyotish. He is a Vedic astrologer, absolutely incredible, blew my mind. You know, I mean, you guys know me, I don't like the box wine, new agey, goofy stuff at all. I hate that stuff. And I was skeptical going in. This guy blew my mind. So go over to facebook.com/Iron Age Jyotish. You can see it up in the top left corner of the screen to go get your very own Vedic authentic astrology reading. Tell him Dave sent you. But we are on tonight with our friend and colleague to talk about the Riggs thing and the Eiders book. Mr. Mark Pereer, how you doing tonight, sir? All right. And we got Tristan with us, too. What's going on, Tristan?
Oh, nothing much for me. I'm just happy to be on.
Wonderful. So let's get started here. I want to talk about, briefly before we get into all the meat and potatoes, Mr. Mark, I want to talk about the book that you just came out with. I believe this was the last book that you've just recently published. It's called The Eider Book, The Official Guide to the Setian Nation. You know, The Riggs Thing presents by Mark Pereer, and this is available on Amazon. I have a copy here, and this is a really awesome book. This is one of the I've never read a book like this before in all of heathenry. Nothing like this has ever been published. Can you tell us about this book here?
No sound for me
I forgot to unmute Mark and Tristan. My apologies.
Oh, sorry. I'm just talking away.
Yeah, we were just talking about before. I was like, man, I've probably done this 5,000 times.
It's a veteran.
Veteran move. Forgot to unmute the guest. All right, so Mr. Mark, tell us about the Eider book.
All right, so I'll start back from the beginning. So the Eider book was, most of the content in the Eider book was in our first edition of the Griffin's book, which was sort of a blueprint for the entire Norna Society, right? When we first started building the Norna Society and creating the ideas for it, we had this, you know, concept that we were just going to try to, you know, do as much as we possibly could, create as big of a vision as we possibly could create, and then see what would happen, right? So we did that, and it eventually, you know, we always knew from the beginning that the research and the academic work was always at the heart of everything, mm-hmm. and it had to come first. You have to lay the academic foundation so that you understand what you're doing, and then you do it, right?
Yeah.
However, the issue came about that as the academic work grew and we started making all these discoveries and all these different things started happening, and it was just getting bigger and bigger and crazier, that we realized that the Norna Society has to remain an academic organization, and it has to remain neutral, and it has to remain on its own as its own thing, because I'm sort of really overprotective of the society, because it's our reputation is everything to me, because it's our work, it's what we do, and it means something to me for this to be about our faith and our folk and what we are trying to accomplish, and that is rebuilding this religion from the ground up and actually using the research for what it is, and not trying to make it into something that we want it to be. And so, you know, I want to go back into that a minute, but the thing is that in doing so, we had to sort of break away. We got rid of the leagues that was part of the Griffin's book. That was sort of the outreach branch. And then but we knew we want to make this clan system work, you know, because this is probably the most authentic way that our ancestors, you know, congregated, that they came together. And so like we see people, you know, and I'm not knocking any organization or what they've done in the past or anything like that. I'm just saying that, like, for myself, I am trying to see what we can do and how we can apply the most authentic expression of this religion that we can possibly develop, right? And so when I see a discrepancy or an issue, I want to understand that issue and that discrepancy. I want to research it out. I want to break it down. What does it mean? Why does this exist? Why do we do this? Okay. So one of the issues for me was when we're looking at the whole concept of like kindreds and things like that, that people use today, not knocking it. It's certainly acceptable. And that's what people do. And it's what they've done for a long time.
Yeah, that's what I do.
But it's, yeah. And, you know, Dave's a part of the society, and I'm not saying Dave, you're a blasphemer or anything like that. You know, it's just saying that you know, in the research, you know, you do see a differentiation between kin and ite. Right.
Yeah.
And kin is K-Y-N, and that's your kindred. And it's meant to be your, like your family, like your wife, your kids, your mom, your dad, your immediate family, right? And we see that in the sort of breakdown of the Fylgjur, which is the, you know, you have the man's Fylgjur, which is the, you know, the Fylgja itself, the Hamingja, which is the guardian spirit of an individual. And then you have the Kinsfylgja, which is the kindred Fylgja. And then you have the Eitursfylgja, which is the Fylgja of the clan. Okay. And then we started looking at concepts like the houses. We have like Húsfreyja, which is the house Freyja, or the, and the Húskarls. And so you see houses, you know, that's basically the same word as kin. And so your family is your house. That's your kin. And then when you combine these together and you form this, you become a clan. And so we knew that this system, it had to be something like that would reach into this authentic sort of form that our ancestors had. And we started looking at like, how would heraldry come about? How would we connect to our ancestors? How would we pass this on? And a lot of this came about so that, you know, once a person establishes a clan and they build one, that it's something that they've developed an entire culture around. And one of the big motivators for me, right, and when I looked at it, is I've noticed over the years and just practicing heathenry and all that stuff, a lot of people have sort of latched on to these languages and, you know, territorial differences in our ancestry. And they say, well, that's my religion. Like, I am a Saxon heathen, or I am a Norse heathen, or I am a Germanic heathen, or whatever, right? And when I see that, I think, well, you know, what did our ancestors think of something like that? What were their views on this? How would they develop a tribe or a clan? What did they do? You know, and so that's what we did. That's what we set out to do, not to try to say, you know, and obviously we look to our ancestors and we look to our ancestral line, and we can find those, you know, bloodline connections to the Saxons or the Germans or the, you know, the Scandinavians or whatever. But the thing is that that's not what our ancestors did. You know, that wasn't their religion. They didn't just go around saying like, you know, we're going to call ourselves after the Neanderthals or the, you know, the Neolithic people or whatever, you know, or the Indo-Europeans before them. They didn't do that. So they had to have a system in place that said, you know, this is how we connect. This is how we congregate. This is how we come together. And so when you do that, you start creating a more authentic line of heritage, because it was always using a person's name. An honored ancestor, somebody that you related to and connect to specifically. And this is how all of the tribes and all of the countries became named in Europe. Like Denmark was named after a King Dan, and, you know, Svea was after the Swedes. And you have all of these different countries that were named after different tribal names that were named after an ancestor that they honored.
Yep.
And so that's what we're trying to do. You know, we're trying to bring back this sort of idea that, you know, that we're taking this seriously. This is our religion. And it's not something that, you know, we want to, if we have a concept there, we want to use it. We don't want to just abandon it and forget it, because it's a part of our heritage. It's a part of who we are. So when I, you know, put together the Eitur book, I mean, the whole idea is that hopefully one day, you know, when we have gatherings, people will come together and they will fly the banners of their clan, and that will be named after an ancestor. And we'll have people like the Skjoldungs and the Budlungs and the Inglings all standing together in the way that our ancestors actually did it.
Yeah.
And that's what I was trying to accomplish.
So I'm going to ask you this, because I get this question, because, you know, I'm very much involved with the Riggs thing stuff. And I absolutely love this book, and I've recommended it to so many people. And I know a lot of other people have really loved it. But one of the questions I get a lot when we're talking about the system of the Riggs thing and the Eit is, as you mentioned, our ancestors didn't organize themselves by, oh, I'm a Saxon, oh, I'm a... I mean, they did organically, obviously. Over time, they became those things. But those things were evolved from patrilineal line. Now, right. In modern times, we look at this and we say, you know, people organizing themselves by Norse, by heathen, or I mean, by Norse, by Saxon, by, you know, I don't know, Lombard, by, you know, so on and so forth. Could the Riggs thing accept people, say, from Slavic heathenry or Baltic heathenry or Celtic heathenry?
Well, that's an interesting question, and it's something that we could definitely consider. You know, I'm not trying to create something that is you know, specifically focused on Scandinavian heritage. I mean, and we're looking at what our heritage is. So the idea of this is that we're trying to build authentic religion for the Teutonic people. And that's the basis of what we do. And we do that unapologetically, you know, and that's not to, but to say that we would exclude the other European traditions is not necessarily what we're out to do. Right. It's just simply saying that this is our tradition and this is what we are doing. So the thing for me is that, you know, as a researcher and educator, my purpose is to teach people how to do this.
Yeah.
And so we know absolutely for a fact that this is the way all European peoples, you know, congregated and came together. So we could show our methods and show our ideas in the exact same way. I mean, you see, like, you know, a lot of what we see in the research that we find with the Scandinavian clans is that it's almost exactly what the Scottish clans do. Mm-hmm. You know, and even down to the concept of naming them, like when you see the name like Yngling, right, it's the same thing as like McDonald. You know, it's because the Mac and the Ing are the same words. The Mac means like the descendants of, the clans of. The Ing means the same thing.
You mean the Ling part?
No, it's ing. So
right, like, the Ing part is from Yngwie. The Ling is the descendant of.
No. So if you have like a bunch of there's a bunch of them. So let's look at Skjoldung, right? Now Skjoldung means the ung, the suffix ung, it means the descendants of. And so I think that's you always add the, make it ung when there's an O in the word and then ing when there's not. So I don't think that it's an L. I don't know why the L is there. I'd have to talk to our linguist guys about that. And because I know what you're saying, that what you're saying is the ing, the ying, the first part of it is Yngwie Frey. I get that. But I'm talking about the suffix of it, the ing.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I misunderstood the grammatical change between ing and ing.
Yeah, another suffix we see is ones, like ones.
Right.
Yeah.
We think that would probably be like a tribe, you know. So what we're looking at is different tiers of organization. You would have your houses or your kins, right? Also called your sibs, which are, you know, families, individuals that make up families, husband, wife, children, mother, father, stuff like that. And then they come together and they form ites, which are clans. And then ites would come together to form tribes, you know, or thjods.
Mm-hmm. The reason I had my question about the Celtic and stuff, you know, because we share a lot of spaces together. Like, I have a lot of friends that are Celtic heathens, friends that are, you know, different types of heathens and stuff like that. And we all kind of share the same circles. Now, our ancestors, you know, especially, you know, you were talking about the Scandinavians, they were notorious for marrying into, like, we'll say, like the with the Brits, marrying with the Saxons, you know, the Danes married with the Saxons during, you know, I mean, there was a whole part of England that was called Danelaw. They married each other all the time. So what if, like, say, you know, I'm about to have a daughter. Say my daughter goes and marries a Celtic guy or a Slavic guy. You know, what's the implications of that? Because this is very much a system that is based on lineage and not necessarily like a universal church like we're used to in the modern era.
Well, that's the thing about this, okay, is that when you're doing this, okay, and you're building this system and you're developing it for yourself, okay, your tribal standards are yours. You know, they're yours to keep. It's you know, Dave, you know this. We've talked about adaptable standards, you know. And there's going to be different tribes are going to have different standards. They're going to say, no, you can't do this. You know, we forbid this. This is what is forbidden. It has to be along this line, blah, blah, blah. I don't really know anybody's going to do that today because we're, you know, so lax in people. But the thing is that people can make that standard for themselves. And that's what we're saying, is that the idea is that we're going to have a core foundation of lore and law and you know, and lineage and connection to that. But then after that, like, we're going to show people how these traditions develop and how they work and how you can make that work within a system. But then once you develop that, as long as it is a system and has a standard, then that's up to you. That's your decision to make.
Yeah. So what you're saying is you're setting the standard and you are leaving tribes, as long as they operate within, let's say, the constitution of the Riggs thing, that they are allowed to have their autonomy, essentially.
Right. Right. That's exactly what it is. And the concept of that, we can see throughout history. I mean, that's the way it was, you know, when the Romans were moving into Germania, you know, their whole principle was that they were going to unify and force everybody under this model. And the Germans fought to the death. They were like, we're not going to do that, you know. And I think Titus is the Roman historian who mentioned where they went into one village and, you know, basically told them, you know, we want to talk to you about, you know, what we're going to do, and we conquered you in battle and all that stuff. And so they went and parlayed with them, and they said, well, we want to maintain our autonomy, and we want to learn from your priesthood. And the Romans said, no, we're not doing all that. You're basically going to be our slaves, and you know, you bow before us, and that's it. And so they said, okay. And they went back in their village, and they killed all of their children, and they hung themselves with ropes made out of their own hair. So they weren't going to submit their autonomy. And another one, you can look at like the Hermann of the Trusci, right? When he defeated the Romans in Teutoburgwald, he thought, like, he got this idea in his head, well, I, you know, just had this great victory, this great battle, so maybe I can be the one that unifies the German clans and tribes. And they assassinated him. They said, we're not doing that. So autonomy is a big deal. It's an important thing. It was an important thing for our ancestors. And we don't want to take that away, but we know that we have to work together. There has to be a system of cooperation for us to work together, because there's so many enemies around us. There's so many things out there that want to destroy us and hurt us. And if we're just standing there as individual groups, you know, and we're all over the place, then we don't have any way to protect ourselves, or we don't have anything that helps us to grow as a community and as a religion.
Yeah. So, Tristan, do you want to hop in here? Because you haven't had a chance to hop in yet.
Right. Well, I mean, I wanted to talk about the idea of a pan-Germanic facet to the faith. Because, you know, some people take the position that the different aspects of the Germanic faith, whether you're Saxon or Scandinavian or, you know, what have you, are actually meaningful subtypes of the religion that should be adhered to and only followed in that sense. Personally, I take a more pan-Germanic aspect of the faith, in which the different parts of the faith, you know, the aesthetic components are meaningful in the sense of lineage, but that they're not, you know, they are fundamentally one connected, united faith together. What would you say about that, Mark?
Well, yeah, I could give a perfect historic example of that. You know, one of the greatest Saxon heroes ever written about, and I've actually spoken with this with some of the guys who favor the Saxon belief, it was Wittekind, right? And a little known fact about Wittekind is that his brother-in-law was the king of Denmark. You know, They were the same. They were connected by family lines, you know. And you have to think of the implications of that. Our family are in these same cultures. They're connected, you know.
Another good example for that is the famous hero, Sigurd Dragonslayer, is thought that his family line came from basically the Franks, even though his mother... When their father died, his mother remarried the king of Sweden, the England king.
Right. So yeah. It's all over the place, you know. And the thing about this is what we're trying to tell people is not to abandon that, you know. In fact, we want to embolden it. We want to make it stronger. We want to give it a life of its own by showing people how you know, Saxons or Norse or Germans or English people or whatever, how they developed their tribes. So that you're not just saying I'm a Saxon, but you could say I'm a Saxon of this clan, of this tribe, just like my Saxon ancestors did, or just like my Norse ancestors did. We're going to do it the exact same way. I'll give you another example. In the Beowulf poem, right, there's the mention of the clan Scyldings, Scylding. It's the exact same word as the Norse Skjoldung, right? So here you have this tribe that's mentioned in this, you know, one of the most famous Saxon poems of all times. And it's actually the same tribe, the Skjoldungs in Sweden, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's generally it is absolutely accepted by general, even mainstream scholars, that the Skjoldings and the Skjoldungs are exactly the same.
Right. I mean, it means the Shieldings. So it's the same word. It's the same people, you know.
Hang on, we got some donos here I got to go through real quick. Uruz, 2 lemons. Thank you, sir. Dino, a lemon. J-Law, a lemon. Uruz, another 3 lemons. Southern Dingo just followed. Southern Dingo says, Dave, we love you. Much love to you, Brother Dingo. God bless you, sir. Exo donates an ice cream and then donates another 4 lemons. Many thanks and many blessings to each and every one of you. Thank you so much for your very kind, very generous donations. All right, so let's get back to the formation of this of the Riggs thing and everything like that. So,
right.
Say somebody has a kindred that is already established. Like, for example, my kindred is Penfolk. We have been together for, it's going to be like I think it's 8 years this Yule. We've been together a long time. What would you say to folks that have, like, this is kind of like our tradition now?
Right.
That we have to come in and we have to completely restructure and everything like that. What would you say to guys like me?
Well, the thing is that we're not asking people to restructure. We're asking people to evolve. You know, I mean, you think about it this way, right? When you see like the history of the movement that we're in, that since it's developed in the 1920s with Alexander Rudd Mills, all right, Alexander Rudd Mills, he was just working off a very basic set of knowledge, and he developed his, you know, beliefs around that knowledge. And he went around and he developed the Anglican Church of Odin.
Yeah.
Right. Now, I don't think anybody in today's age would set up like an Anglican Church of anything in the name of heathenry. Right. But that's what they had. But it evolved from there. Okay. So the thing is, for me, and trust me, I know your pain, man. I've had to rewrite entire books from research, that just new research that came and all that stuff, right? Yeah. But we're not telling people, like, just completely change what you're doing and all this stuff. What we're saying is that the positions that you have and the things that you're doing, they're all still there. We're just trying to solidify this for history's sake, you know, so that, like, the leader of the clan is the leader of the clan. The leader of the kindred is the leader of the kindred, right? And how you can, you know, develop names, and you can work out the system, and you can look at the system and see how it connects. And then, you know, the heads of each clan will become the Riggs thing. That will become the government of the entire organization. There isn't going to be somebody like an overlord, like a, you know, a top down group. It's going to be these clans are going to form, and then the heads of those clans form the government of that entire organization, of that entire alliance. And so the idea of that is to develop your group, to flesh it out more, right? And to learn the traditions and grow as an organization, which is going to happen no matter what.
Yeah.
So what we could say here is that to join the Riggs Ting and to be a part of it requires very little actual change in structure to the group, just a very bare minimum that would allow entry into it, and everything else is acceptable under the auspices of individual autonomy.
Right. And well, there is a standard, you know, and the standard is something that's going to allow you to develop an odal that's stronger than anyone's ever had before.
Yeah.
Because we're teaching people heraldry, you know, we're developing our own heraldric system. And we know that our ancestors had one because we have the word Eiterskjold, which means clan shield. Right. And that it's a heraldic shield. Vigfusson points that out. Right. And so we know they had this. We're going to teach people how to develop their heraldry. We're going to teach them how to use the symbols of their group and how to develop them out and flesh them out to create like a language of symbols that creates this family crest or the clan crest and helps you to grow as a group, right? And develop a motto and develop totems and develop all of these different things that will help you to grow. And we have like each stage of your development. We call it the year of establishment. And each stage is done on a month by month basis. So you have 12 months, right, in a year, right? And each month you're going to focus on a different concept, a different idea. And probably the most drastic thing I understand that would come about with that would be people's, you know, the names of groups. But like for yourself, you have to ask, like, you know, do I want to reach that state of authenticity? Or you know, and I understand, like, you know, people aren't going to be cool with that. I get that. People have their names and that's what they've done and that's the way it is. And I totally understand that. And I'm not trying to tell people you're bad or anything like that. I'm just simply stating that for myself, I am always trying to seek out the most authentic form of this religion. And there have been times when I've had to eat crow and basically say, you know, I think that I have reached the point where I'm trying to force this model. And I was telling you guys before the program, you know, that like the latest thing was with the calendars, you know, and I want to thank Robert Sass for his research in that, because he helped me to understand more about how the calendars work. And the biggest contribution that he gave me in this was showing us, you know, the source material that showed how the Christians changed everything to match their calendar. And that was a big step for me, because I was like, you know, I basically was just trying to use the models that we had, because I didn't think we had anything that was complete. And that was my mistake, because I've learned over the years in researching this stuff that every time we're told that we don't have it, you just got to go look, because we do. And we always have, you know. And so I did. I went and looked and I found this Masary calendar, which is a pre-Christian polytheistic heathen calendar that existed in Iceland before Christianity came. right? And I started learning more and more about how the bloats work and how the festival calendar works and all this stuff. And I was like, I reached the point where I just saw so much on it and found so much and just kept learning more and more. I was like, okay, well, I'm sorry, we have to scrap this other stuff, you know? And so I'm totally rewriting all that, you know? And that's just the way it is when you're trying to rebuild a religion. To rebuild a religion, you have to accept that you're in the process of construction. And sometimes you just have to knock a pillar down here and there and say, look, that's just not right. We got to build it back, you know?
So as far as, like, if, say, folks do join the Riggs thing, which I hope they will, I'm joining it, and quite a few of us are going to be joining it. When we join this, what does the Riggs thing provide for us? Because there's a lot of people that they join other organizations, we'll say national organizations, and they're in it for a long time, and they feel like they just kind of go in, sign up, maybe they pay dues, or maybe they don't, maybe, and they just kind of feel like they just, you know, they signed up to fly a flag, and nothing else comes from it. What would the Riggs thing provide to them that other organizations do not?
Well, the big thing is, and I would like to emphasize this greatly, is that we're going to give people a tradition, right? And that's the most important thing. That's what all of the religious groups, everybody is trying to do, is give people a tradition. And I personally think that the top-down model is kind of where it's not harmful, I don't think, or anything like that, but I think that it reaches a point where everything is about the organization, rather than about the people that are involved in their own individual group, or, you know what I'm saying? Like their own kindred or their own clan. And so it's all about, like, this group, you know? And so we don't want to ever emphasize that the Riggs thing is the thing, you know, this is what matters, this is what's important, because there was nothing like that in ancestral times. And there was an emphasis on the individual tribes and clans. And that's what matters, because that gives the people who are practicing and part of this, that gives them their legacy, their odal, you know. And we're going to be filtering all of the information from the Norn Society into this. We're going to be teaching people how to perform bloats. We're going to be developing religious orders in this. We're going to make sure that when you do this, when you are involved in this, that you're going to be given the most authentic form of this religion that you possibly can have in your hands. And that when you form your clan, you form your tribe, you're doing it the way our ancestors did it. And you will be taken seriously as such.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the thing for me is that a lot of times when people see, like, these fantastical names of kindreds and stuff like that, I mean, it seems like LARPing to people, you know. And I'm not trying to be mean and saying that, but it's like, you know, when you know, if you're like, I'm 33rd dragon kindred or something like that, you know, it's like, people don't take that seriously. People on the outside don't, you know. And it's like, we have to reach a point of authenticity where we're saying, this is what we do. And you look at, like, how other unbroken traditions exist, like the Shintos and the Hindus and stuff like that. They're very serious about what they're doing. And it's not a joke. And it's not something that they try to make any sort of light of, you know. And so when they're looking at something and how they, like, how do we take the next step on this, they will sit there and just pour through texts and books and figure out how it's done. And they've done it for thousands of years. Well, we have a broken tradition that we're trying to pick up the pieces on. And so when we look at this, we want to say, like, you want to wake up in the morning and say, I am a part of something that I know comes from our ancestral lineage. And so when you read, like, the poem Hindlegild, right, and you look through it, and they break down all of the family lines, the clans, the sacred clans, and they, you know, basically just talk about, like, the divinity of it all and how it's so closely connected to the gods and how it's, you know, it's a religious system, but it's also a tribal system. Then you know that you've touched upon something holy and ancestral.
And I don't know if you wanted to touch on Kvasir Academy. Is that something you'd like to talk about?
Yeah, sure.
I just wanted to talk about real quick as far as what the Riggs thing offers that other organizations do not. It offers the most sophisticated type of teaching for a priest class that has been available in our folk for probably ever. Yeah, at least in modern times, for thousands of years. Right. You know, we are one thing that I've always had a critique of, for, and I don't mean to say this to upset anybody. I'm just saying this because I'm just speaking from my heart, speaking truth here, that for many years now, we have had a priest class that is not as sophisticated as other religions. And I've always been very envious of that. When, like, I did the interview with the Acharya, like a month ago, that man walks with the excellence of the gods. I'm not even a Hindu. And I was just, just so impressed with this guy. He just exudes a holiness about him. You walk, you see a Buddhist monk or priest or whatever out in public, they exude holiness. You know, these guys, they walk with the excellence of the divine of their faith. And we don't really have that. When a Vedic priest walks into a room, people bow. We have never had that. You know, in our faith, it's been hard enough to get people to even, like, listen to what the priest has to say. Because the priest orders have not even really been orders. They've just been some guy that gets elected. You know what I mean? Like, that's not something that you bow to. And then there's also been the stigma against bowing and the stigma against having reverence and the stigma against religious authority. And it's like, how do you have a religion without a religious authority? Well, in the Riggs thing, we are going to establish a lineage of religious authority that has not been seen since the ancient times. And it's going to be something very, very, very primordial, something very special, and something that is very unique for our religion. It's going to be the first time this has happened, as I said, in, like, we're talking a millennia.
Right. Well, yeah. And the thing about that is that it all comes down to trust. You know, it's about trust. And a lot of people, when they hear us talk about authority and rules and structure and all that stuff, they freak out and they think that, like, you know, we're out to, like, you know, create some sort of crusade against people or something. Right. But really the idea of it is that we see that without a foundation, without some sort of education and experience and, you know, a standard, then what you have happen is you have developed these cults of personality and people who, like, you know, somebody starts up a YouTube channel and they get popular and then it's, you know, what they say matters and because they're popular. Right. And that's such an arbitrary and capricious system to live by that you're just setting your rife, just completely setting yourself up for abuse. You know, I mean, we see now we're all looking at, everybody is paying attention to all of these sex scandals that are coming out of Hollywood. Right. And everybody's so shocked by this. And they're just like, oh, my gosh, I can't believe this is happening. It's like, really? You can't believe this is happening? Like, what standard have these people ever had in their lives? You know, they basically were just people who had a minuscule, pathetic talent. And then that minuscule, pathetic talent was blown up completely out of proportion. And these people were given anything they ever desired. And it's like, and you didn't expect corruption to come out of that? Of course you do. You know, it's insane that you wouldn't think that. And so the thing is that when you're building any sort of institution like this, there has to be a level of trust, because the trust is what the authority is. That's what builds the authority, right? And so you have to have trust in the institution that's being built, and you have to have trust in the people that are building it. And so, you know, we are going to do everything that we can to put layers of trust within that institution, so that when people, you know that they're not just speaking with a person who claims to be a Gaudi, but they're speaking to a person who has been educated through Kavasar Academy, who's been given the insignia of their position, then that insignia is going to convey a layer of trust upon you, so that you will know that when you go to speak to this person, that they live by a code of ethics and they live by a standard that allows you to trust them when you speak to them.
Yeah.
And so, like, how many people sit there and think when they go to speak to a Gaudi, right? And I'm not saying that this doesn't happen. I'm sure it does, right? But I'm saying, like, you want to be able to know that the person that you're speaking to is firmly educated, that they have gone through a rigorous vetting process, that they have been treated, you know, through an actual ritual of experience and knowledge and understanding, so that when you go to speak to them, you know that they're going to come back to you with some valid information and good advice and good help. And this is something that's going to affect people's marriages and how they have children and how they raise their kids, because you're going to have advisors and you're not going to feel alone in that department.
Yeah.
And I think actually that's one of the most fundamental things to having a priestly order, is that these people are actually significantly more educated than the average practitioner of the faith. Because for so long we've been in a situation in which anyone could call themselves a Gothi, and most of the people doing so were not significantly more educated than any other random practitioner.
Right. Yeah, and like we see in the sources that they talk about, like, you know, the Gothords were selected from the most righteous of men. you know, and that's, that means something. Righteousness means something, you know, it means that they devoted themselves to the gods, that they were devout. And that, I mean, that's how you get the word godly, the godly one, the pious one, one who is disciplined. That's how, that's what conveys that air of holiness that you were talking about with other priesthoods, Dave, is that there's discipline and there's devotion, you know, and those two things are what makes that, that sort of air exist for those people. You see it, like if you were to pay attention to like a Shinto priest, this is a person who is disciplined and who's devout and focused on his religion and meditates and prays and lives his life for the kami, right? And this is what we want for our devotion in our gods, is a person who lives their life for this and has that devotion and has that discipline.
Yeah. I interviewed a Shinto priest on here pretty recently. Yeah, and he's a very nice man, and I exchange emails with him once in a while, and the amount of devotion that this man has for his shrine, his Shinto shrine, I forget what the shrine's called exactly, but is unreal. This guy goes, he's every single day, whether he's sick or not, he's going there now with the COVID outbreak, he wears his mask to service people, he doesn't care if he gets sick, nothing. He's there all day, every day, his entire life. And when he's not there, what he does is he goes down to the train station and he puts up a sign that says, share your problems with me and let me take them off your chest. And he sits down, he just listens to his people. And it's because, you know, they're all, he loves his Japanese people. He loves his people, and he wants to, you know, he's in service to his folk. He's in service to the divine. And that's he's really about it. He's not just some weekend warrior, internet LARPer, whatever. He is the real deal, and that is what we need in this faith. And that's something that, and I'm not saying that there aren't Gothies out there that don't do a good job. I'm not saying all Gothies are bad. I'm not saying that you know, it's been a joke up until now, we have the best ones ever or anything like that. But what I'm saying is that there has not been a standard, you know, that when I want someday when a Gothie walks into a room, they recognize that he's a Gothie, and they feel some kind of way. They show reverence that, yes, sir, yes, Gothie. You know, that's the real deal. That's a real priest. Maybe they do bow. Maybe they do, you know, whatever. And he can give them counsel. People can trust in him. You know, that's I want that real deal. I want that real thing in our faith. And unfortunately, there's the stereotype that doesn't exist. And, you know, it's a mixed bag. What you're going to get, you're going to get some goofball. You're going to get some internet LARPer. You're going to get some guy that blows coke and, you know, tries to, you know, get ladies in the back room after a bloat. You know what I mean? You never know. You never know. Right. I'm not saying those guys are a majority, but I've heard those stories. And that's those people need to be bogged. We need to get, like, that's an absolute disgrace. Can you imagine our ancestors, if there was a time where there was a priest that acted like that, he would be executed. Right. It would be like, you know, whatever. Gothi means of God, of the gods, of the divine. It means that you are the divine representative here on earth. And you have to act as such, and you have to be educated as such, and you have to know as much. You know, I mean, I just watched like a Facebook Live thing, some goofy guy, Gothy Greg or something like that. It's like, I was like, he's got classes that he gives for, you know, $300 a piece, teaching about the runes or something like that. And I go in and do his chat, and I start, you know, pressing him. I'm like, pressed him on a cosmological argument. He had no idea. I asked him about virtue ethics. He had no idea. I asked him about the nature of divinity. He gave me the thing that the gods are symbols and trees and, you know, whatever. And then it's just like, I was like, this is exactly why we do the work that we do in our own society, is so Gothy Greg goes out of business.
Right. And the thing is about it is that, you know, you and I both know authentic Gothies, right? And Gideas, right?
Of course.
And I'm telling you right now, and we speak to them all the time. And the ones that are authentic and real thirst for knowledge and devotion. And so when they hear something like this, they're going to be like, yeah, let's do that, you know, because they're going to want to see it. We all who are doing this, who are truly devoted to the gods, get excited when we see new developments take place, you know?
Well, you know, the only people who have a problem with an increasing in standard and responsibility towards others in the organization like this are the people who realize that somewhere down the line, they are going to be penalized because they're not going to be able to live up to the standards.
Yeah.
Right. They're going to Yeah, I mean, they're just going to be the ones that get thrown out of the organization.
And right. I just want to clarify, you know, I mean, I had a lot of, like, you know, negative things to say about our faith, people that are, like, new to our faith that are just looking in from the outside. That's not the general rule. Most people that have the title of Gothi, that legitimately have that title, they do a good job, and they do to the best of their ability. And I know a lot that are really, really great. So don't take it as, you know, I mean, we're a religion that's full of corrupt priests or anything like that. That's not the case.
Not at all. In fact, I would say, like, you know, the standards that we're developing and the thing that we have is going to, you know, basically give us a way to keep that corruption from ever taking root, you know. And it's like I said, there are great people out there. People are going to have a divine calling no matter what, no matter how much information you have for them, right?
Yeah.
But when you have that divine calling and you see that information arise, then you're going to thirst for that. You're going to want that. I know I do, you know, and I love it when other groups like Arya Akasha and Survive the Jive and all these different, you know, Ald Sidhu and all these guys pop up and they start creating great research and they're putting information out. You know, all the people that are authentic flock to that and want to see it and want to be a part of it. And all the new agers who, you know, just don't want authority and don't want rules and think this is some kind of anti-Christian reactionary religion, they're the ones who scoff at it and get mad, you know.
Yeah, if you want to see that, go look at Survive the Jive's video about how to pray like a pagan, where he talks about how pagans kneel, and look at all the you know, butt mad comments that are in his comment section about how pagans don't kneel.
Right.
Or, you know, the Arya Akasha, when we went after Varg for saying, you know, the gods aren't real, they're just non entities you just think up in your head. And, you know, 40 comment long threads of people just getting super ass hurt about it.
Right. Yeah, and that's the thing is that, you know, these guys, they get mad, but it's like, I'm not out to tell you that you're wrong. I'm asking you to prove your position, and you can't, you know? And that's the thing. It's just prove the position that you have. Because people, you know, they come to me and they ask me, you know, about this stuff, and they want to know, and they, you know, they have questions about this and that and the other. And then, so when somebody asks me a question and I can't answer it, then I want to know why I can't answer it. And I start looking, and I start trying to find it out. And the kneeling thing was a big deal because, like, we all thought that. Everybody thought that. Like, we just don't kneel. And then it was like, well, where does that come from? And then people started asking me that, and I'm like, okay, well, I'm going to go find it out. Where does it come from? I'll tell you where it comes from. It comes from Anton LaVey. That's where it comes from.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't come from our religion. There's no source anywhere. And people say, well, you know, they talk about the act of kneeling, like the physical act of kneeling and whether or not they did this, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, no, we're not talking about that. We're talking about the refusal to prostrate yourself before the gods. Does that sentiment, does that attitude exist within any source anywhere at all? And it does not. It doesn't exist.
In fact, the opposite is shown. What is it?
Completely opposite.
We have several sources in which people explicitly kneel and prostrate themselves before the gods.
Yeah, what is it? Tacitus, where it shows that they have to enter through a gateway with their hands and ankles bound in chains, right, or something like that. If they fall over, they have to crawl back out and start back again or something like that.
Right. And his quote in there is that he says that they do so to recognize their inferiority and the superiority of the gods. Which
and
shows
also Ibn Fadlan, the Arabic historiographer, recorded amongst the Rus tribes that when the merchants would come in, they'd have a big god pole and they'd literally prostrate themselves before it and offer them, this is all my product, this is what I want, this is what I would like to give, this is my offering to you. And if they didn't get the response they'd want, they'd do even more grand gestures.
Right. Yeah. And that's it. And we have, you know, from the sagas, we have, you know, concepts of blasphemy and concepts of, you know, banishing people for blaspheming the gods. And you have words like Atrunatar, which basically means a person who is, you know, not of the faith, not faithful to the gods. And you have Trunatar, which means faithful. And so these terms,
those who are literally godless.
Yeah. And so it's like these people had this, and these are pre-Christian terms. We know they are, you know, and they weren't just running around doing this, you know, this sort of modern caricature of religion, you know. And the thing for me when I looked at all that stuff is like, what made these people so unique? Why was their religion so unique? If you see all of these other religions all across the world where people have devotion and they have concepts of like things like damnation and they have concepts, all these different things that sort of tie religions together in sort of their basic premise, then what made ours so unique? Well, they didn't have that. Well, the fact was they weren't unique. You know, this is a religion, and it has all the definitions of a religion, and it's not some sort of new age game that people want to play.
Yeah, we got a couple donos in the chat. We have Bartleby, the best wrench ever. Well, I guess we're axes here in on the bog. One of the best bog lords I could ever have. He says he just subscribes for a month. Folks Farmer just resubbed for 3 months, is now on a 2 month sub streak. We got Exo just subscribed for a month, and our boy Folks Farmer come through the Ninjini. It's about a lifestyle. No LARPing, he says. And Uru says Mark's passion is inspiring.
Well, thanks. Folks Farmer's a great guy, and I owe him a script, and I promise I'm going to get it to him.
Yeah, that's our buddy right there.
Yeah.
All right, Mr. Mark, we're coming up on, we got 10 minutes left. Is there anything you would like to touch on when, in regards to the Eider book, the Riggs thing, anything of that nature?
Well, I think that, you know, the one thing I would like to emphasize for people, you know, for myself, is that I'm the director of the Norn Society, and I'm a very busy person. You know, I have four kids, I have a family, I have a job, I have all kinds of things that I'm constantly doing, right? And the Norn Society is my first love and first passion, and it's what I'm always going to do, you know. The Riggs thing is something that I want to see happen, and I want to see it take place. But I don't want anybody, and I've always tried to emphasize this in everything I do, is that my goal and my vision in life is to try to rebuild this religion, not to make the Mark Pereira show. I'm not out to run the Riggs thing. I'm not out. I don't even know if I'll ever have time to ever really set up a clan for it. I may, and it's something I would like to do, but I'm a very busy person. And so that's why I want to say that, because I don't want people thinking that I'm coming here to tell everybody, you know, this is what was going to happen, this is what we're going to do. I want this to develop organically. I wrote the Eider's book as a guidebook to show people how this could work and how we could use these ancestral traditions to create something great that I feel would truly be great. But I'm not out to be like the guru. I'm not out to be like the guy running the show. I'm going to leave that to other people. Dave's going to take a big part in this, and a lot of the people going to be running the clans are going to be taking a big part of this. And I'm going to guide them and educate them and show them, but I'm not here to run this. And that's what's going to be different about this organization, is it's going to be something that people are going to build from the ground up. And then when they do it, when they're done and they know they're done, then they're going to know that they have something that is as authentic as you can possibly create.
Yeah, I actually I stepped down from my place on the board in the Norona Society to focus on the Riggs thing, because I agree with Mark. It's time that the Riggs thing and a lot of this research that we do in the Setian movement gets put into real life, gets put into action. And it's time that we establish a truly primordial tradition that rings on forever. Well, I'm not just talking about, you know, just an organ. And this, none of this, sometimes we get, you know, those of us guys that are into the scholarly stuff, that we kind of get the stereotype that we're being elitists or something like that. But I assure you guys, that's never our intention to act like that. Right. You know what I mean? We're not trying to.
No, Dave, no one has ever accused me of being an elitist. Well, Tristan, I want you to know that.
Tristan's an elitist. All right, we'll see. But, what we're trying to do is we are people that are devoted to the gods 100% and devoted. We're really about this. I mean, I don't want to speak for these guys, but when I say I would die for this, I would die for this. I believe this with all my heart and soul. I believe that this is the way for our folk. I believe this is a way to a new future. I believe this is the way for us to have defense against the myriad of sickening tentacles that is modernity, the machine of modernity. I believe this is a way home for our children. You know what I mean? So I give my heart and soul to this. I'm really about this. That's why I'm so, you know, I mean, we're so hardcore about this. And I'm very proud to be a member of the Norona Society, and very proud to run the show, The Bog, and, you know, stuff like that. The Bog, you know, I mean, a guy messaged me pretty recently. He said The Bog made philosophy cool in Ossetru. You know, and that's pretty cool. I mean,
that's pretty great.
Yeah,
so that is actually rather cool.
Yeah, he said he would have never thought in a million years that him and his kindred would be talking about Socrates and Aristotle and getting into philosophy and stuff like that. But now they are, because they watched The Bog. And that was such a one, that message was like a gift in itself. I felt so proud of that. But what I wanted to get at as far as, I love my spot in the Rona Society. Everybody knows I shield in Rona Society like crazy because I absolutely love it. You know, I mean, we're all three of us here are all in the Rona Society colleagues, and it's something that I love. And I stepped down from a spot on the board to help with the formation of the Riggs thing. And I want people, I want to reiterate what Mark said. I get pretty full of myself sometimes. I like being a showboater and making people laugh and entertaining people and stuff like that. But what is it truly in my heart is authenticity. And I give people that my word that, I pour my heart and soul into this. This will never turn into the Dave Martell show. I already have a Dave Martell show. My old show was called the Dave Martell show. I don't need another one. After this, that's good. So I want to build it to help build it in a way that is the most authentic as possible. And I have a lot of visions that I would like to try to implement and try to give people the best tools possible so they and their family may have the best possible connection and experience when practicing their ancestral faith.
Right.
Well, the way I've always looked into it is thinking that – instead of making like a cult of personality that's like some mediocre thing that no one's going to remember in 10 years, but you might get personal accolades here and now. Imagine being a person who is partly responsible for an actual revival of an authentic religion that carries on forever. The reverence you would get in the afterlife from your own ancestors, from the gods, because of your participation in this sort of thing. I mean, it's even in your own best interest to behave correctly and appropriately and authentically, even if you're just totally self-interested.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. Well, my thing, I tell my wife all the time, because sometimes, life gets hard and you go through tough things and you start to, you question your faith, you question what you're doing because you sometimes hit roadblocks. Mm-hmm. But I always tell my wife when that happens, I was like, look, we have a choice here, right? It's a fork in the road. You can give your children this, what we're building, or you can let them have that, which is what they're building, right? And you know what that is, the degeneracy, the just complete moral and soulful decay of modernity. And it's like, because if you don't give them this, that's what they're going to have, because there is no other path, there is no other direction, And so that's the thing we have to ask ourselves. That's what we have to do. And so like when I see people, even people who are traditionalists, people who are more focused on family and culture and stuff like that, you get so angry at the modern world. You see the rage and the hate and just the constant barrage of news and footage and things that just makes you so mad. And it's like the only reprieve from that is this. Is to have an authentic tradition, something that's built out of love and devotion and caring and being a part of something greater than yourself. Because if you constantly focus on the modern world, you are going to destroy yourself. You are going to fill your heart with so much hate and so much anger that you're not going to be able to come back from that. And I've actually seen that happen to friends of mine who lost their wives, who lost their families, who lost everything because they just delved into that and they could not get out of it. And that's why we're here.
Yeah, exactly. What did Nietzsche say about staring into the abyss so long it starts to stare back or something like that?
Right.
That's exactly what it is. You spend all day on Facebook or Telegram or on Twitter or what, watching the news or watching sports ball or what have you, engaging into the world out there, and you're like us and you have you are of a traditional mindset. I'm not knocking anybody. Some days I read stuff and I start feeling mad. You know what I mean?
Right.
Who doesn't? If you have your heart in this, you love your family. If you're not some scumbag weirdo, you're going to get mad. It's going to piss you off because it's terrible. It's the worst possible reality that we could imagine is what's going on here. And, I guess it could get worse. It could always get worse. But you can't just sit there and stew in that. You can't let that, because it will swallow you. It will destroy you. You will become it. It will victimize you. So instead of doing that, you need to help build something that has longevity. Instead of complaining about your enemies, become your enemy's enemy.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing is I'm saying is that like when you feel that anger and rage, you know, you have to step back and ask yourself, what am I going to do about it? Right. And for the longest time, people's answer to that question was, well, I'm going to get some guns and I'm going to go kill as many people as I can. Well, what kind of answer is that? You know, how is that a response that the only way you see yourself being successful in life is by going out and killing a bunch of people? Then you become them. You become exactly what you hate. Right.
You know, it's a very primitive human response that when you lash out in anger, you just want to hurt someone. But you got to, you know, think about this for a moment, that our true enemy isn't a physical person that you can stab and make them bleed. You know, it's a system, a construct, a society network.
Right. It's and we have to defeat it with our own society network.
Exactly.
And we have to ask ourselves, like, you know, do we want to just fight against something or do we want to fight for something? And that's why we're doing what we're doing. So people have something to fight for, to care about, to believe in something greater than themselves that makes them love being who they are again.
Exactly. Exactly. Hang on 1 second. Let me check out. I got a chest here. I'm going to distribute some rewards. We got another dono from Folkish Farmer. Another Ninjini making it rain. He says, looking forward to our sacred stew, Mark.
Yeah, yeah, I'm definitely wanting to do that. I get pulled in so many different directions, but I do type away on it a little bit here and there. That's going to be a great video.
Yeah,
I think at this point, everyone wants to go eat with Folkish Farmer.
Oh,
I get so excited when I see his videos, man, because I really love, you know, we focus so much on lore and history and ritual and all that stuff. And he's really fleshing out like one of the fundamentals that gets overlooked. And it's what makes me so excited about what Folkish Farmer does.
Yeah. Everybody likes to eat, man. Who doesn't like to
eat? That's right.
And
that's right.
I can't tell
you. When you go to Greek festivals, you aren't there to watch people dance.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I can't tell you how many people message me and they say that they're like, man, every time Folkish Farmer comes on, my wife complains about our kitchen because he's got this beautiful kitchen. I was like, yeah, me too. Yeah, dude, somebody needs to go over and bust his kitchen up a little bit. Like, it's too nice. Like, we got to.
He just does that for the show. It's all a mess like 5 minutes before.
It's not even a real kitchen. It's a green screen.
Right, it's a great
right.
Yeah, but yeah, folks, I just we are coming up on the end of time here, but I want to get people to check out the Eider book. It's available on Amazon. Somebody can drop a link in the chat if they're available or not. I'll just get in the description eventually when this goes up on YouTube. And I just want to tell people, man, don't get blackpilled, man. Don't get all depressed and miserable about modernity, because there's people out there that are pouring their guts, their heart and soul, blood, sweat, and tears into building something that is going to oppose that and that can be gifted on to our children and our children's children forever and ever until the end of time, until it comes back around and we reach a golden age. And three of those people, there's so many of those people out there, three of them are right here. I give you my word that Big Dave, Mark Pereira, and Tristan Powers are going to work our balls off until the end of time to give our children something special and to commune with the gods in a way that has not happened since thousands of years ago. And we are going to come home. We're going to come home. We're going to reach a primordial form, and we're going to reach this golden age. Trust me, it's going to happen.
Hail.
Hail to that. All right, Mr. Mark, do you have anything in closing? You want to shut it down?
I'm good, man.
Good to
go. I think that was a pretty good show.
Beautiful. Wonderful. Tristan, do you have anything?
Not particularly. Always good to have you on, Mark.
Yeah, it's great to be on here, man. I love coming on this show with you guys.
Absolutely, Mark. We love having you. And I'll see you guys next week on The Bog right here on DLive.tv/Dave Martell every single Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern. You can catch all of our replays over on my YouTube channel, which is Dave Martell. Make sure to check out our friend up in the top left corner of the screen. Where is it? Right? Up here. Iron Age Jodish. I'm telling you guys, man. I thought horoscopes are goofy, and horoscopes in the West are goofy. Let's get real here. Yo, I'm a Sagittarius, I'm a Gemini. That stuff's goofy. Like, it's, you know, Big Dave, I don't like the box wine, new age, goofy stuff with the cat ladies and all the girls, like the girls with the two wolves moon shirt, and they got the, like, dream catcher earrings, and they're selling crystals at the flea market from that they pull out of their Winnebago. Like, that's not the kind of stuff. I'm completely against that stuff. this guy blew my mind with real authentic astrology from the Vedic tradition. Really true ancient stuff. He gave me a reading. He like predicted things that I never told anybody. You know what I mean? Stuff that like my wife didn't even know. I'm telling you. I'll give you guys an example. He predicted that I had I got an injury to my ankle, knee, or outer thigh in my late childhood, and when it gives you a limp or something like that. I was like, how did you know that I wrecked my BMX bike when I was 14 and now when it rains I limp? You know, he knew that. Like, that was, I'm telling you, it wasn't just one thing. It was a lot of things like that. So, guys, make sure to go check out facebook.com/IronAgeJyotish. Tell him Dave sent you and get yourself a reading. It's going to blow your mind, I promise. But anyways, guys, I'll see you guys next week, Thursday, 9 p.m. Eastern here on The Bog. Hail the gods and hail the folk. I'll see you guys next time.